Hey, all, it is so good to see you. I am so sorry that we didn't get to meet live, but this is Sonia Simone, and I am recording a Q&A for you. This is October 2022, and so I'm going to get right into it. I think most of you all know me pretty well. My name is Sonia Simone. I was one of the co-founders of Copyblogger Media. I'm a content strategist. I'm a longtime business writer, and I have recently launched the Creative Fierce website, as well as our wonderful Creative Fierce community of implementation, which we've been running for about 2 years now. So before I start in on the questions, I wanted to point you all to the next free workshop that we have that is going to touch on some of the things I talk about today in more depth. I'm going to talk about the new authority in websites. I'm going to talk about how we can create an authoritative website we're proud of without putting, just hundreds of hours into it, because nobody has that much time and that many resources. And then I'm going to talk about my framework for making sure that you are always on track. That framework is called VESPA. Today, I'm going to touch on a shorter version called VEP, and you'll get a link to that in the replay. So let's get into the questions. We've got lots of good ones to cover, so I want to get rolling on it. The first one, I have a pair of questions that are related. One is from Kathleen: how do we know if we need a content audit? And the second is from Maria. And her question is along the lines of developing content for a website and posting on social media at the same time to build an audience. So, for example, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. Is this a good idea? So just ideas about how to post our web content and then our social media content at the same time. So the answer to both of these is the same tool, which is why I paired these questions. In terms of a content audit, I really suggest you avoid it if you can, because it's a mammoth job. It's expensive to have somebody do for you. The most common reason for a content audit is for search engine optimization. You have a large volume of content, even maybe a site like Copyblogger that has millions and millions and millions of words, and you need to get it cleaned up for search engine optimization. It's a big job. It's an ugly job. So I would say don't do it unless you absolutely know you have to do it. But there is a tool I recommend instead. And I think the best iteration of this is one that I found from Karanda Adair. I met Karanda in Mexico when I went to Cabo Press. And she has a technique she calls the pot of gold. So I'm going to give you a link to her small product on creating your own pot of gold in the replay. I would suggest it's only $50. I would suggest go pick it up because she's going to walk you through it, in detail, and it's very good value for money. But basically what a pot of gold is a database. So she uses Airtable, and in her product, she walks you through how to use Airtable. It's a database with all of your content in it. So you have the text of the content, you have, keywords, it's searchable, you have your categories, you have links. You might keep track of like where you linked out to. All the things that you're going to want to identify with a content audit, if you just keep this pot of gold as you go. And then maybe backfill it when you have some time, throw 5, 10 posts in there when you have time. You're going to end up with a document that's going to be more useful than a one-time audit. That's going to be, again, it's going to be expensive, hard to do, and then it's sort of one snapshot. So pot of gold approach, I think, is much smarter. Keep track of your content as you create it. And then if you have a lot of content previously, throw it in there when you have time or get somebody to do that for you. That is the kind of work that a VA can do very efficiently, with Karanda's instructions especially. So you don't have to go with her thing. You could just throw them all into an Excel spreadsheet or something. But I think for the for the cost, I think our product is would be a good investment. It's one that I'm going to be making shortly. All right, Clara's question. I struggle with coming up with content ideas for my copywriting business website. I'm not entirely sure what will appeal to potential clients and other possible lead generation content. So this is a really good question. It's really smart to ask this question because you can really get kind of bit if you don't ask it. As writers, we tend to assume we need a lot of content. And we've been told that for a long time by a lot of people. Write every day, write every week, publish, 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 publish. And there was certainly a time and a place for that kind of volume focus. But I think it is really time to look at that more carefully and do that in a smarter way that protects your time and protects your energy. So honestly, copywriting websites in particular, people who hire copywriters, 99 times out of 100, do not spend a lot of time reading newsletters written by copywriters or blog content written by copywriters. They're just not. The people who want to pay you are not the people who read that content. The people who read that content are your brothers and sisters in copywriting. They're other writers, which is great, and community is great. But I think a lot of times copywriters spend more time than we should be spending creating content that's not for the audience we actually want to sell to. So, some thoughts on what your audience will need. I would say table stakes, just the bare minimum. Your site has to look acceptable. It doesn't have to look like the latest and greatest, most fashionable web design, but it should look good. It should be clean, easy to navigate, professional looking. It's to your advantage very much, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, to have a photograph on there of yourself. And it needs to have the important pieces, about page that's clear, a services or a work with me page that tells people, how you work and how they can move forward. I would have a link to your portfolio, and I would definitely put lots of testimonials throughout the site. Another thing that you can do, because content is not wasted on copywriting clients, it's just a different kind of content. Think about some downloadable resources on what you are really strong at. So if you're really strong at email strategy, then I would consider creating something like a checklist, or one or two page document. Make sure your conversion-focused email campaigns are including these elements. And then make sure your contact information is at the bottom. What you're looking to do with these downloadables is give your clients, educate your clients a little bit on some business strategy if they're looking for it. Make your content, your contact information easy to find. And in a perfect world, they're going to print it, or they're going to get the content manager to print it and stick it on the wall behind their laptop at work. And they have it as a reference. And then when they need an overflow writer, they've got your name and your contact information. So think about printable focused materials, downloadable materials that are focused on strategy more than like writing advice. Another really good one for content for any service providers, so copywriters, but also coaches, graphic designers, anybody who does a service, is celebrating your client stories. Case studies, these can be one paragraph, they can be a whole, full-blown case study if it's maybe a more technical field or a more involved field. How much content you're going to give your client kind of depends on how complicated is the project that you do. But you always want to be thinking about making a case for how you do your projects, and then also illustrating how clients have used your process to get success, so that this client can have that for themselves. Now I realize I didn't talk as much about Maria's question, so I want to circle back to that because it's very relevant to this question about content ideas for a copywriting website. When we have our pot of gold, when you have a good searchable database of what you've already written, you pull things out of that for your social content. So you can pull things, and that's why you want a database or, a decent spreadsheet. You want to be able to search. You want to be able to search for categories, themes, keywords, so that you can find short fragments of your longer content. And that's what you use on your social media. And so how you use it just depends on the platform. But social media in general rewards short content that opens up questions, opens up feedback, opens up conversation. Social media, every social media platform on the planet wants to foster conversation and engagement. So it's the open-ended questions, it's the food for thought, it's the raising a strategic question and then making an attempt to engage a conversation about how you address that with your process. So that's how we go from our longer form content, our blog posts, but also our podcast scripts, our video scripts, our white pages, our manifestos, all of the writing that we create, we want to keep leveraging that and slice and dice it up for other projects. Take your blog posts, turn them into podcasts. Take your podcast scripts, turn them into social media content, rather than constantly reinventing the wheel. All right, so I have another pair of questions from Cynthia and from Terry. Cynthia's question is, how do I determine the amount of how-to information to share for free? Cynthia's case would be blog posts, versus paid. So, how much to share for the free content, how much to share maybe in a freebie, downloadable freebie, like an incentive to sign up for your email list, and then how much to share in a paid program. Cynthia is a marketing coach for new solopreneurs and restarting women solopreneurs who are selling services. Terry is publishing a paid newsletter. So it's the same question, but a little bit different product. How do I figure out what to monetize versus what to keep as free content? So in the newsletter, when your only product is what you're writing in the newsletter, how do you develop a content strategy that ensures value for the free folks and for the paying folks? And this is one of those age-old content questions. You can ask it a million times. It's always worth kind of revisiting in your own business. What buckets? The free bucket, the incentive bucket, so somebody maybe traded an email address and got on your list, and then the paid product bucket, a course, a paid newsletter, or your one-on-one expertise. And you typically make the divide by mapping out what your buyer needs to make a purchase. What does the person who spends money with you need to know to move forward and buy from you? So, circling back, you remember we talked about VEP. I will give you a link to that in the replay. VEP stands for values, expertise, and personality. And that is like really the cornerstone of what people need to know from you before they move forward with a purchase, which is why it's so useful to keep your content on track and keep you from going too far afield. So, V values, they need to know that your values are aligned. Honestly, in 2022, 2023, people are not willing to do business with people whose values are really opposed to their values. I mean, some people are, but a lot of people are not. People want to know where you stand. This is an era of boycotts. This is an era of people just not wanting to put dollars in pockets of people who are, doing things that they think are damaging. And all things being equal, people would much rather do business with somebody who's aligned with them. So it was always important. It's really important now. So your values, it's really just part of what infuses your content. Everything that you write comes from the point of view of somebody who is willing to stand up for things. It's not necessarily always political, but you should know what you stand for. Then expertise is kind of the meat of the sandwich. Expertise is what do you know how to do that helps your audience solve their problems? And that is sort of the question when you're deciding on these buckets is what level of problem will you solve for this audience member? And that's how you make that decision. Free with an incentive and paid. So free content asks less of your audience. It's going to solve a lower level problem. Free content is going to solve the first few steps on the path. Free content, one of the things it should be doing is it educates your person so that they can be an informed buyer, so that they're prepared. You wouldn't want to sell, I don't sell coaching to people who are just starting out in business because they're not really in a good frame to make good use of that product. I would much rather they consume my free content and get to a point where they've got something, they've got a little bit of momentum, they've solved some of the initial problems, then they can really make use of that higher dollar product. So free content solves the beginning problems that your audience faces. Free with email, so like content you would put in a downloadable and a white paper or a, email, autoresponder, something like that, solves kind of the next couple of steps. We're still in early days, but it's going to solve the problem in a little bit more depth. It's going to help people dig a little bit deeper, start to see some progress. And then the paid solution solves the most complicated problem. Now, realistically, we always overestimate how much attention people are paying to our free content. And so I know more than one very successful business who sells as a paid program the same thing that they put in their free content because it's one thing to have it in a blog post, and it's a very different thing to have it in something like a cohort-based course where you're showing up and doing the work and getting accountability. So sometimes it's just the format. Sometimes just the format is more useful. You also want to think about the more you are asking somebody to invest their time and their emotional energy, the more dollars should be attached to it. Partly because people don't act on free information. There's so much of it. So you'll have two or three people in your audience out of 100 who will be able to take your free stuff and run with it and implement it. And those people are great. They can be fantastic for word of mouth. They can get out there and say, you know what? I like got all this stuff from this person for absolutely free, and I created this really good thing with it. So don't resent those people. Those people are amazing. Most people won't do that. So your paid, your coaching, your one-on-one services, your paid newsletter helps people solve the problem. It gives them a more robust toolkit to solve the problem they want to solve. Paid newsletters is kind of a special case. Paid newsletters, essentially, what you're publishing for free is the introduction, more or less, the highlights, the first or and second paragraph of the news article. But the real in-depth how and why is where you'll probably save that for the paid newsletter. So these things always depend very greatly on the specifics, but that's going to give you some good sort of rules of thumb that you can use to make decisions. And I would not get, for the paid newsletter, you want to have more of a line. You have a paid newsletter, you need enough free content that the person is just itching to go ahead and subscribe. So you've whet the appetite enough that they're just itching to go ahead and subscribe for coaching, courses, all the other things. You can err on the side of being a little overgenerous because honestly, people who are course buyers are not going to spend a ton of time with your free content. They're going to cut to the chase and get the course. People who want one-on-one time with you are going to skim at best your free stuff. They're waiting for you to give them an opportunity to work one-on-one. All right. These are such awesome questions. Thank you all so much. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more. Let's talk about pages. Let's get into some specific web pages. We have some really good questions on that. Susan has a couple of good questions along these lines. The first is she's working on her about page. Her preference would be to be anonymous. So I would like to be anonymous, but I understand how that might impact trust. What do you recommend? Would there be a problem using more of a like an illustration, a cartoonish character on my website? And I'm not sure how to handle an about me portion. So I have seen this come up a number of times. I have several friends who do business under business names, aliases, pseudonyms, for a variety of reasons. Very well known is James Chartrand, who did business as a woman masquerading as a man for a long time, and finally revealed her gender identity on Copyblogger. It's one of the highest traffic posts we ever had. It was somewhat controversial, but this is a thing people do, and more people do it than you realize because, of course, most people who are working under a professional name don't advertise that. So you have probably people that you follow and read on blogs who are not using the name that's on their driver's license, and you don't know that. There are some issues, and I'll get into a couple of them here. When you can, it is very beneficial to put your photograph on your about page. There is just people really prefer to do business with people. However, it also depends a lot on what you sell. So if what you are selling is more information products, then really, the person doesn't care as much about your face. They care more about your what qualifies you to teach them this piece of information. How do you know? Why should they trust your advice versus somebody else's advice? So you can go with, more of a persona, and but then you have to back it up. So I would say if you think about it as a scale. Right? You've got a balance, an old-fashioned scale. If you are not putting a photo on your website so people can create that very human trust of person-to-person trust, then you're going to have to put more things on the trust side of the balance to weigh it out. You're going to want to have testimonials where people have benefited from what you do. You're going to want to have, if you have educational credentials, you're going to want to put them on there. You're going to want to probably have a little bit more informational content. You might want to use footnotes. I mean, it really depends on your topic, but you might want to include your references. If you have academic references, references to scientific papers that your audience does not have the expertise to read for themselves, put that on there. Get your business signed up with the Better Business Bureau and put a Better Business Bureau sticker on there. If that's something that exists in your country, put the trust, the secure checkout logo on. You need more trust if you're going to have less of that. It's just putting your photo on is kind of a cheat. It's kind of a hack. Here is my face. You can see my face. We are meeting each other face to face. That creates trust. It's not really deserved, but it is what it is. You could also, if you're into it, create that rapport with your voice. You don't have to include your face. Maybe you have some audio content. Maybe you have some limited edition podcasts. So people are responding to your voice. That also is wonderful for creating rapport and trust because a person feels like they know you. They feel like you're not just some, maybe you were some like hacker, overseas hacker in Russia or somewhere that's just stealing credit cards and it's just popped up a sales page and they're going to run off with the cash. So that's what you're trying to counter. And I know like I know this person. He's a really well-regarded SEO. I think he's mostly retired these days. Did lots of business, made lots and lots of cash. And I don't know anybody who knows his name. He goes by Godhammer. If Godhammer can make a great living, you can make a great living, but you have to make sure people understand in the absence of knowing maybe who you are, if you're disguising your real name or you're disguising your face, you need to give them other signals so they can trust you. All right. And then second question from Susan is resources for writing a homepage. And she had a really good observation. She says, it seems like when I've asked this to others, I'm not getting a concrete, actionable response. I would like to know what to include on a homepage. And the reason it's hard to get specific, delineated advice on this is that individual businesses have very different homepages. And even sometimes the same kind of business can have, some pretty different things on the homepage. So I'm going to tell you first what makes homepages so difficult to write. It's very similar to what makes about pages so difficult to write. And that is that you come up against at the end of the day, you have to decide on the one message you want people who come to your website to take away. Because your homepage always gets more traffic than anything else on your website. Just unfortunately, just does. I mean, unless you're doing something like buying tons of traffic to something else. Your homepage has to work, right? It has to deliver one message, and we don't want to decide on one message because we're complicated and because we're multifaceted and because we're interesting and because we're afraid of the path not taken. We're afraid of all those people we're not getting because we're deciding on this one message. And I feel this more than I can tell you. It's probably my number one challenge in my own messaging. Is I want to convey the overarching totality of what I have to teach. And that's not what you need on your homepage. So, you need to do work that is unenjoyable, honestly, to make your homepage, in my experience. Now, some people nail it right away because some people don't struggle with that. And so, I mean, I love that for them. I mean, I think that's like so cool, but that's not where a lot of us are. So I'll start with a very classic fill in the blanks exercise. We've published it on Copyblogger. I'm sure you've seen it before. It's just out there. We're filling in the blanks now. I help blank. The first blank is who do you want to work with? And you have to just make a commitment, even though you don't want to, because you don't want to leave other people out. You have to make a commitment. I help people I help with. And then the most important problem that you solve, healthy, like my client, Georgie, who I love so much, Georgie Fear. She's brilliant. She has a book. You should go buy it. She has a couple of books, actually. Georgie Fear. Helps particularly people recovering from binge eating disorder lose excess weight without compromising their health via her credentials as a registered dietitian and years of specialized study with binge eating disorder patients and what is beneficial versus what is counterindicated. Okay. So the framework, the fill in the blanks version is I help blank That's your who. With, that's their big problem. By, and then your solution. And again, what qualifies you to do it? So I help blank with blank by blank. I will put that in the replay notes, so you have it. You don't have to scribble. So we have to do that, and I will tell you, you might have done it a dozen times, and you'll probably do it a dozen times again, unless you are somebody like Georgie, who has really found this amazing niche that nobody else is doing and that she's just so good in. A lot of us, do this over and over again. And you have to do it over and over again when you change audiences or when you change solutions or when you change problems. So, if you've done it before, it's very possible it's time to do it again. I will also in the replay give you a perfectly decent resource. I think I found something from HubSpot on what should be on a homepage. Just knowing that is very generic. And so, because of that, there might be things that are not relevant to you. You have to make that executive decision to say, I know this is what HubSpot said was good, but it doesn't, it's not suitable. So we always have to make those executive decisions. And then final word on homepages is that there are a lot of ways to do this correctly, and you can change it. We changed it a lot at Copyblogger. We went through lots of different iterations of what was on the homepage. And WordPress makes this quite easy to do. You just say, set this page as my homepage. So don't feel like when you have a homepage, you got married to it and that's how it has to be forever, because it's just not. So I would say a couple of things you definitely want on your homepage. You want people to be able to sign up for your email list. Typically, you want them to be able to follow you so that you can communicate with them. You want to include the biggest problem that you solve, and you want some trust credentials on there. You want to give people a start on knowing, I actually do know how to do this. This actually is my wheelhouse, and I have helped people before. I would always put a testimonial on my homepage. But a content-driven business, very commonly the blog is the homepage, or these days, because we have more sophisticated design tools, the blog is part of the homepage. So a lot of times, like if you go and look at Copyblogger, what they've got going on right now is a big email sign-up with a big promise, and then there's content under that from the blog. And then sometimes a homepage is a hub. It's a gateway for multiple buyer types. I had a client who did, she helped organizations do fundraising. And she had a couple of different kinds of organizations that she helped that were both very important to her business. So her homepage, the first thing it did is say, if you're this kind of buyer, here's your resources. And if you're that kind of buyer, go to this part of the site. And then on, it's really like two different sites, but the homepage is the lobby where they can choose the door that they're going to go to. And then final word on homepages, I really think it's a smart idea because there's so many ways to get it right. That's what people won't tell you. There's so many good solutions to this question, what should be on a homepage? I would visit websites for 10 or 20 businesses that you like, you respect, maybe people you do business with, and copy the overarching structure of the one that you like the best and you think would work for you. You are not copying their web design. You are not copying their words. You are not plagiarizing in any way, but you are looking at what's on their homepage. Oh, well, they have a strong statement of benefit to their buyer. There's a testimonial, there's a menu at the top, and then there's an email opt-in. And they're kind of arranged roughly this way. That you can steal that ethically. Okay, that's not plagiarism, that's just inspiration. Because there's not just one single model. And if you go with, I'm not going to say you're going to look like a cookie cutter, but if you go with just like the template from your solution or whatever, without maybe thinking about some different things you might do with visuals, what color or messaging, you can look a little cookie cutter. Which is not the most wonderful thing you want to do. Now, you can fix that with great headlines and great images, but don't feel like it has to look like everybody else's. As long as your message is clear, people know how to sign up with you, and they have a good sense of like the person whose problem you solve gets to that homepage and says, okay, this is worth my time to investigate more deeply. That's really all it needs to do. All right, cooking along here. I'm actually going to stop the recording here because I want these to be small enough to be, reasonably downloadable and not too excessive. So I'm going to stop here, and then we will pick up with Joel's question about managing our mental wellness with our business.